Happy Earth Day, everybody. The show has been the Green Morning Radio right here on WORT 89.9 FM here in Madison, Wisconsin. WORTFM.org. Next week, PC Allen with One Fine Morning. Have a good one. Be good people.
BBC News. Hello, I'm Eileen McHugh. The International Monetary Fund has warned that among advanced economies, the United States will be the hardest hit by a significant slowdown in growth driven by President Trump's tariffs. The IMF has slashed its forecasts for the US economy from 2.7% to 1.8%. It blamed trade disruption and uncertainty stirred by Mr. Trump's policies. Pierre-Olivier Gourinchard is the IMF's chief economist.
We were seeing already consumption numbers coming down. We're seeing consumer confidence coming down. We are seeing the probability of a recession increasing from about 25% back in October to around 40%.
The outlook for nearly all countries has been downgraded. The Trump administration has announced plans to drastically overhaul the State Department. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said programs which were misaligned with America's core national interests would be cut. Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
The planned cuts at the State Department include the Office of Global Criminal Justice, which helps set policy on the U.S. response to war crimes and mass atrocities. Another office whose functions look set to be radically changed is that which deals with refugees and migration. The cuts involve some 130 of the more than 700 agency offices within the State Department as part of what Mr. Rubio is presenting as a major restructure, he says, to cut out radical ideologues and bureaucratic infighters. However, the proposed overhaul does not go as far as some US media reporting in the run-up to the announcement.
More than 20 people are feared dead after gunmen opened fire on hikers at a remote beauty spot in Indian-administered Kashmir. The authorities have yet to confirm the number of casualties, but unofficial sources have told the BBC that at least 24 people died in the attack on tourists walking from the resort town of Pahalgam. The Vatican has revealed that in his final moments, Pope Francis expressed gratitude that he was able to greet Easter worshippers just a day before he died. Francis had become unwell a couple of hours before his death, with the Vatican saying the end was quick and he did not suffer. His funeral will be held in St. Peter's Square on Saturday. Sarah Rainsford has been following the day's events at the Vatican.
The Pope's apartment was sealed and the papal seat declared vacant until a conclave and an election. Now, at the chapel of his residence, he is lying in a simple coffin. Tomorrow morning, he will be carried from here to St. Peter's, so people can then file past and say their own goodbyes. The funeral will be on Saturday. The cardinals and the crowds are already gathering.
Sarah Rainsford, reporting from the Vatican. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. Russian attacks on Ukrainian cities have continued 2 days after the expiry of a partially observed Easter truce declared by President Putin. Ukraine says a strike with guided bombs on the city of Zaporizhia killed one person and injured 26. The region's head has published video of a badly damaged high-rise residential building. Elsewhere, the authorities say a massive drone attack on Kharkiv has left 9 people injured. There's been a large explosion at a military base in the Vladimir region, northeast of Moscow. The Russian Defense Ministry said a fire had detonated ammunition at a warehouse. Danny Eberhard reports.
Video footage of the incident shows a vast fireball and billowing plumes of smoke. Its force clearly impressed one witness, despite being filmed from several kilometers away. Russia's Ministry of Defense put the blasts down to what it called a violation of safety requirements when working with explosive materials. Such incidents do happen in Russia, but Ukraine also attacks Russian arms depots. Ukrainian reports indicate the site houses an arsenal of the main missile directorate.
Ghana's president, John Dramani Mahama, has suspended the Chief Justice following 3 separate petitions seeking her removal. A 5-member committee will investigate the undisclosed allegations. Gertrude Tokonu was initially denied access to the petitions, but has now received them. She will appear before the committee to respond to the allegations. Astronomers say they've spotted a rare rocky exoplanet, which is disintegrating as it orbits its host star. Scientists say the planet sheds material equivalent to the mass of Mount Everest every 30 hours, leaving a tail of dust 9 million kilometres long. It's one of only four exoplanets which have been observed disintegrating in orbit. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Children's Theatre of Madison, presenting The Trials, May 2nd through 11th in the Starlight Theatre at the Madison Youth Art Center at 1055 East Mifflin Street. The Trials addresses the climate emergency and intergenerational conflict. The play is intended to spark discussion and debate about climate change, responsibility, and accountability. Recommended for ages 13 and up. Tickets and information at ctmtheater.org.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025 edition, the Earth Day edition of A Public Affair. My name is Patty Peltakos, and I'll be your host this hour. On this Earth Day edition of A Public Affair, Julia Bourdais, illustrator, author, comic book artist, bicyclist, traveler, will be speaking with us from Europe. This summer, Julia set off on a quest, what she describes as a decarbonized journey, sketchbook in hand, by boat, bike, and train, without a car or plane. Julia spent 7 months traveling through 22 states, including stops in New York, Chicago, and the Burning Man Festival. During her travels, Julia says, "I met environmental activists and Americans from all walks of life. I tried to understand their views on climate issues during the presidential elections when Donald Trump was elected." So today is a public affair will be devoted to Julia's travels. And WORT listener, I know you're wanting to hear from Julia, as am I, but first, I want to let you know that Julia is participating via Zoom in UW-Madison's EarthFest. This Sunday, on April 27th, Madison Bikes and UW European Studies invite you to Two Wheels, Many Stories, a graphic artist's journey to interview climate activists across the U.S. That's this coming Sunday, April 27th, 11 a.m. at the UW Arboretum. Julia's Zoom is one of many UW-Madison EarthFest events, and you can find out more at earthfest.wisc.edu, and you can also check out Madison Bike's Facebook page. And now, Julia, welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi, Patty.
Hi.
Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for joining me on today's show. So, Julia, I'm really curious to know the background of this completely crazy idea, how you decided to tour the United States by train and by bike.
It's a very, very long story, actually.
It's okay.
I guess it began on 2022. I published my first graphic novel, and my book was about a young Japanese woman. She became a widow. She lost her husband, and he's the best fisherman in Japan. He dies, and she must deliver the remaining corpse to the emperor. And so we follow her journey to the imperial city. And I guess it's a story about self-discovery through the physical experience and like traveling, encounters, and about transformation into someone else. And I gave a very big place to forest and landscape into my book. So I think this is the starting point, that I really love to draw nature. And so to promote my book, I went to a bookstore tour, as a lot of authors must do when they write. And I ended up staying at the home of some of my friends who were shifters. So shifters, in France, we call people transitioning to a more sustainable lifestyle, shifters. So I started wondering why I hadn't already made that shift myself, especially since I was raised in a very countercultural family. And that's when I got the idea of going to a tour of the eco-activists that I know of in France, and to find my own reason to shift. That was my main idea. And so at the beginning, I was not imagining myself into USA. I wanted to do that in Europe, well, in France, because my network was there, and also because of financial reason. I think it was the opportunity of Villa Albertine's open call that gave me the idea of to transpose my bike trip to the USA. Villa Albertine is the attaché culturel of France in USA. So it's part of the consulate of France, and they give grants to artists to go on exploration, artistic exploration in USA. Well, and it goes also for American artists to come to France. So it's like cultural exchange. So that gave me the opportunity to go in USA. And also, I think I have I had a romanticized way of thinking about USA. I was a very big fan of cinema when I was a teenager. I was obsessed with counterculture in USA in the 70s. And also, I have a family experience of women reclaiming freedom through traveling. And my mother took a very big trip in USA when she dumped her first boyfriend in the 80s. So I really had this strong connection with, I don't know, feminine freedom through USA. Like, for me, it's really like, okay, I will just go and take like a few amount of items that I really need to survive, and just like go on my journey, and like, I don't know, seize the occasion, any occasion. And so, yeah, I also wanted to ride across USA because, I don't know, in Europe, we have this vision of wild spaces and like immensity. And I had this fantasy shaped by the story of my mother, of the cinema, of maybe I saw a few too many times Thelma and Louise, maybe.
So I'm also really wondering then, how did your bicycle become a part of this? And when this idea was forming in your head, in your thoughts, was the bicycle always there? Or did the bicycle somehow kind of work itself into this vision, this idea that you had to go on this trip?
For me, bicycle was always related to freedom. I think the last generation has the same relationship, but with car. I have this relationship with bike because as a teenager, my parents' house was a bit outside of the city, and the bus was not really reliable. So I needed to. I had only my bike, but I really, you know, as teenager, you have very strong feelings, and I remember just like listening to music on my bicycle and like feeling free. And so I can remember that. And also because I always had this weird relationship with sport, I guess bites was not in my head related to sport. It was commuting. It was like traveling. It was not sport. So I don't know. It gave me another relationship to using my body. And so I think, yeah, I began to ride my bicycle just after the attacks in Paris, because I was very afraid to take the metro. I was feeling very anxious after Charlie Hebdo and after the 13th of November. So I don't know. And very soon, when you ride a bicycle, you can feel joy. You can feel like you feel connected to your body also. I think it comes very quick. And also you can feel your muscle, like you can feel that your body is reacting. You have endorphins and stuff like that. Well, I don't know if it's called endorphin, but you can feel the chemistry in your body.
Right, right.
Yeah, and also in 2015, it was Me Too, the Me Too wave also for my generation. So I think it connected really strongly with my feminism, because I could feel that I could go anywhere and wore any clothes that I wanted. And like, I don't know, go home at the time that I wanted. It was not dangerous. Like, yeah, I reconnected with freedom. I was a student in Paris at that time. So yeah, I think it was part of my construction as a young adult, a young woman. Mm-hmm. And also after that, when COVID hits, bicycling was part of like the liberation, because I was commuting from Paris to Rouen, which is nearly 150 kilometers. So it's one day, it's like 9 hours of biking, following the Seine River. And it's very hard, but it's very rewarding because it's beautiful. It's where Monet and all the impressionists used to paint. So it's like so beautiful. And I felt very empowered. Yeah, I have to say, yeah, I was taking my bike because moving was not really allowed. So I was kind of, playing with the rules at the time.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So, yeah, I think all of that, it's about freedom, the freedom of being a woman. And maybe after that, I joined a community of women in Paris. Like, it's a group of women only, or affiliated women. I don't know how to say that. But, we write in group of women, and we make some traveling. So the last one was to Mont-Saint-Michel. And so it's about community also. So I think it came from individuality to community. So I guess for ecology, it's a strong model, like to find your own reason to choose a lifestyle and to transpose that into community.
So is the group of women that you're a part of, do you all also bicycle? I mean, is bicycling a part of that group?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was not very clear. Yeah, it's called Free the Cycle. And it's only about biking. We don't see each other if we are not on our bike.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It brings together very different women also. So it's very interesting. I think it's like having a dog, I guess. Like you finish to talk to people, never.
Okay, so I'm wondering, since you are an artist, and this is veering off on a tangent for a moment, but do you feel like you have been influenced by all of the bicycle posters and the art posters about bicycles and bicycling and travel, that are such a part of kind of bicycle history.
Oh, like maybe the Tour de France and stuff like that, like the visualization of
like the tour, but also just there are so many advertising posters from the early 20th century, the late 19th century for bicycles. And you know, I mean, a lot of them show women on bicycles, mm-hmm. and the whole idea was that you could be on this bicycle and you were free. I mean, of course, some of the clothes were not freeing, but you know, just that idea of here is the bicycle and go ride, go explore.
Yeah, that's very true. I never thought about that actually, but I guess maybe this cultural, this graphic culture is not so strong. Or at least maybe I don't know it. But yeah, sure. And also it's interesting that you bring that because I began my education as a fashion designer. And so I have this kind of image in my head popping, like beautiful woman in bicycle with like a long skirt in the wind and stuff like this. Yeah, I guess maybe it's part of my fantasy also of, you know, on a bicycle, you can wear whatever you want. Actually, I saw that in the bike culture, you have also a lot of gears and clothes that are appropriate and stuff, but I really like the idea of, like, you know, as a dog, like your bike looks like you, like if you are a bit hippie, maybe he got flowers on it and stuff like that. And if you are very sporty and very, I don't know, committed, like sport wise, maybe it's like a car, you know, like I think, I don't know, graphically it's interesting to see that, yeah, bike look like their owner. So I don't know about the posters, but maybe it's an interesting idea.
Okay. Well, we'll just leave that one for the moment. Okay. So if you are just joining us, you are listening to the Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025 Earth Day edition of A Public Affair. My guest today is Julia Bourdais, an illustrator, art director, comic book artist, who is joining us from Europe. And Julia is talking with us about her recent travels to and in the U.S. Her journey included traveling via barge, cargo ship, Amtrak, and bike. She talked to a lot of Americans about climate issues, which I promise we will get to, during the presidential campaign, and she's working on a book about this experience. If you have a question or comment for Julia, please give us a call. Our number is area code 608-256-2001, extension 9. You can also email us at talk@wortfm.org. So, Julia, I mean, you came by boat. I mean, you took a barge down the Seine, and then you were on a cargo ship from Le Havre to New York. I mean, what was it like being on a cargo ship? And could you ride your bike on the deck of the cargo ship?
Believe it or not, you are not the first one to tell me that. But actually, I received an email telling me, like, we are sorry, but you cannot ride your bicycle on the deck because it's so dangerous and you will slip and, like, you will just, like, fall into the sea.
Right.
So, unfortunately, my bike is called Satan because Calamity Jane horse was called Satan. So I named my bike after him. So Satan was in safety in a cabin. So I didn't saw him during all the transatlantic. I took a barge through following the River Seine, and this was actually crazy because I started from Rouen, which is my hometown, and it looks a bit like, yeah. So as I told, is the country of impressionists. Mm. So
the cathedral, the Monet, and the cathedral in Rouen. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can't take it anymore about the cathedral. I think I saw it so many times. It was actually really weird to go on this boat and to just see the town like go away. And I don't know, it was a bit like the Conte in The Lord of the Rings, you know? And very soon you enter into the zone of the port in Le Havre, which is full of oil transformation and petrol. And so it looks like, I don't know, chaotic and very dark country. So it was really full of contrast, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
It was so interesting to meet those people because they are living with the rhythm of the river. And it's really a job that I didn't knew. So I had the opportunity to ask a lot of questions as well. And also their vision about ecology was actually really interesting, I have to say, because it was so different from what I had in mind, because for me, a person who worked on the river was like, had to be a little bit interested about environment, but actually it was not. So the exchange was like very, very rich. Because they have the corporation in mind, they have the job and
work. They have work to do.
Yeah. So yeah, and like recently, the authorities built some fish areas and stuff like that, and so they were not really happy with that, and I could not say anything because actually I can understand their point of view, but mm-hmm. also, okay, but if you kill the river, you don't have work anymore. So it was actually very interesting to meet them also because I could tell that the communication of the authorities around that question was not well made. So I think we have work to do on that part also. I arrived in Le Havre, and Le Havre is a very big port area, and it's also very related to my family history because my grandparents were part of that. And I know that the city is, you can tell that the city is really built on the port activities, and it's a very strange and a very strange, I don't know how to say that, ambience. Like, you know, it's a lot of metallic thing, like huge, you know, the proportions are completely crazy, and you feel so tiny and so vulnerable to this kind of environment. And so, yeah, I felt a bit scared at the beginning, like, okay, I'm here to study ecology. What am I doing here? Like, in the middle of this, I don't know, kingdom of, you know,
industrial fit?
Yeah, really, it's that word that I was looking for, like industrial. And you can feel as a human that you don't belong here. So it was actually really interesting. And actually, I was not allowed to ride my bicycle on the port because it's so dangerous. Because you know, like a human is not made to be there.
Right.
So. Right. You have to drive a very, very huge machine to be on the port.
Mm-hmm.
So when I embarked into the boat, into the ship, I could tell that the seamen were a bit intrigued by my presence. It was not, I was not really meant to be. So I was on board for 10 days. To go to New York, and on my way back, it was a bit longer, so maybe 15 days. Mm-hmm. The company is Marfret, which is a French company. It's considered tiny if you compare to other companies on the market, like CGM and CMA. Marfret is proposing... embarking some artists on board to offer them to create art on board and to understand better how it works and who are the workers on board, because yeah, it's a very specific life. It's so interesting. I could talk about that forever. It's a very man world. It's very, I don't know how to say that in English, but it's global. Like, it's like the world, but on a boat. Mm-hmm. So you have all kind of national identities, of languages, and you have actually diplomacy problems, because like for instance, when on my way to New York City, on board, we had an Ukrainian and a Russian. So we have this kind of diplomacy. And I don't know, I think we have a wrong image of seamen, because I discovered that they are very, poetic and also dreamers, I have to say. Like... when I talk to them, like for instance, I talk with an engine worker, and he told me like he was so passionate about his work. Like he told me like I could spend my whole life working on this machine, because I don't know, to give you an image, like it's a machine of six floors, so it's huge.
Oh, that's
it's
huge. Like,
yeah, it's enormous. And as a drawer, I have to say that I had access to the old boat, so it was amazing to be able to draw all that, those tubes and I don't know, pressure measurements and tools and I don't know, and everything is manufactured. It's not natural, like it's the opposite of natural. So it was interesting also to begin with that, and also being in the middle of the ocean, which is the worst natural environment for a human. Like everywhere in the boat, when you are looking, you have security instruction. Like if you fall into the sea, you are basically dead. So everything is about safety. You have drill all the time, and so everyone is also, you have a feeling of community, because everyone is, you know, not taking care is not the good word, but everyone is looking to each other.
Right, you're all relying on each other.
Yes.
You all depend on each other.
Yeah.
So were you the only passenger, or were there other passengers on this giant cargo ship as well?
No, actually, it's part of the company willing that artists should be alone as an artist, as a passenger, because they don't want to build a team inside the team. They want the artist to like discover the team and to try to, even though it's a bit complicated, I was the only one, the only artist to stay just 10 days, but usually artists on the Marius is the name of the cargo ship, artists that embark on the Marius, usually stays maybe 1 month, like minimum. So 10 days is a bit short actually to really, really connect with people, but I tried my.
Right. And so we do have a message from a listener. Lisa from Madison just left us a message saying she loves hearing about Julia's travel experiences and the freedom of being a woman on a bike. Thank you, Lisa, for calling in. Thank you so much. And WORT listener, we would also love to hear from you. You can reach us at area code 608-256-2001, extension 9, to ask a question or to leave us a message about what your thoughts are on today's show with artist, illustrator, and traveler Julia Bourdais. So, Julia, you got to the United States and you traveled by train and by bicycle, basically across the U.S. How did you decide which portions of your trip were going to be by train and which by bicycle?
To begin with, I was a bit delusional because I never went to USA. So I didn't had really the length in mind, the proportion of the country. So I think that helps me, you know, when you don't know something, you just go for it. I decided to do like that because that's actually how I travel in Europe. But a lot of people warn me about Amtrak. But actually, I really loved it. I find Amtrak wonderful, and I really encourage anyone to take it. But you have to keep in mind that there will be surprises, but it's part of the journey, you know?
Surprises, and I think that you have to allow an awful lot of time when you take Amtrak, because time is very... On Amtrak, the time is all its own. It's all its own world on Amtrak. Yes.
But I think time is a very big part of my future book. Like the question of the timing, the question of how we see time, what we do with our time, what takes time and all. I think... in my everyday life, I try to, make the most of my time. And that's what I really liked on the boat, on the train. So I had this amount of time and it was the reverse process. I have an amount of time and I had to fill it with drawing and writing and meeting people. So it was a bit different from what I used to do.
And so how was that different from the time on your bicycle, or was it not different?
The time on the bicycle is actually very rhythmic, you know.
Yes.
You wake up, you have to eat, you have to, I think everything is really, it's not shortened, but it's really rhythm. You have to follow the sun, you have to eat, you have to charge your phone, you have to...
And you're pedaling, which is a rhythm of its own.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of moments I had to feel an amount of... I don't know. I had to, make a distance. Yeah. So I had planned a distance to make in a day. So right. I had to really, you know, go there.
So you were thinking about distance, but at the same time, you were meeting and talking to people.
Yeah, that's actually was the hardest part of the residency, is that I had so many things to do. So bicycling, taking the train, and also produce my book and planning interviews, and also like following what was happening politically in the country. Mm-hmm. Because a lot was happening at that time, and even in France, we had a very big political crisis.
Yes.
So it was so interesting also to follow the rhythm of everything and make to hierarchize.
Oh yes, a hierarchy.
Yes.
To prioritize.
Exactly. So that was the best part. But my main focus was drawing and interview. And to answer your first question, that's how I planned my journey. So I planned some interviews. And so I decided, okay, then I have time, so I can bicycle. And now I have to take a train because I have to be in Colorado, in Denver or whatever. So I have to take a train. Ah. And also I took the train for the most dangerous or longest part of the country. Like, for instance, I met a man that crossed the USA with his bike. Mm-hmm. And he told me, like, don't go through the field in Ohio. It's too much. It's too long, and you have something else to see in this country, like than 15 days in the field.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, when you started interviewing people, were you tape recording them? Were you just drawing them? Were you doing both?
Yeah. I was doing both. So at the beginning, my technique of drawing drone interviews was not really like fluent, I have to say. Mm-hmm. So I was recording in the same times, but I was really adapting to the person and to the moment also, because I can tell that at the beginning, I tried to record with my iPhone, like videos, and I can tell that there was a distance between my the person that I was interviewing and myself. So I could tell that the drawing is an amazing tool, because, you know, it's not frightening. You can draw someone and speak in the same times, and people are mostly curious and amused by the drawing, because it's a, you know, it's a point of view. It's not the reality. So it's already a transcription of the reality. So people are less frightened mm-hmm. by drawing. So I really loved this media to meet people. And also a lot of time I was just drawing by myself, and people come and talk to me because mm-hmm. I was drawing. So it was a very good way to meet people.
Yeah. And so as you were drawing, as you were talking with people, what did people tell you in response to your questions? I mean, what, I guess, and this is probably a big part of your book, but yeah. What, when you were talking with people, did the thoughts that you had before you left, before you came to the U.S., did those thoughts change as you were traveling and interviewing people and hearing what they had to say.
Yeah, very much so. That's actually the biggest part of the book. What strikes me is that when I left France, I was telling people, yeah, I want to interview Americans. So first of all, I just realized that Americans means nothing because there is so many ways to be Americans and of point of views and specifically at that time. And I don't mention like South Americas and North Americas, of course, like it's a very, very big difference to begin with. So what people told me, well, it depends where. I have to say that it depends on the context always. Like my main realization was that when you interview someone, you have to search for the context before, like where does it come from, and like what did he lived before. For instance, the people who take the train in USA are not all people. Like I spoke with a lot of Amish, a lot of former prisoners, tourists, a lot of young people also, or very old people, like doing tourism and I don't know, maybe romanticizing the train, and also a lot of nature lover, outdoorsy people. So yeah, I guess the context is the main thing to look at, and also I could tell that the people that I met were very confused by the political momentum. And I don't know, a lot of people tried to explain to me what was happening, and every time I had a new answer. So that was actually so interesting because I could tell that no one had the same comprehension of the moment.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you had the opportunity to talk to little kids.
Yeah.
And what the little kids thought. I mean, I'm guessing that they loved being able to watch you draw. And if you were able to talk to them about, you know, things like what they thought about the future.
Yeah. Actually, I guess it reinforces me in my, I don't know, in my illustrating and a drawer experience. Like, I can feel that it's important because a lot of kids that I encountered told me that they were very frightened by future and that they were talking about catastrophes and like not knowing what to do and yeah, like very terrifying stuff. So yeah, we really enjoyed drawing together because most of them I met them through the school because with Villa Albertine, I was invited in some schools to make some workshops, atelier. Mm-hmm. So I had the chance to talk with them. And yeah, I think what was the most disturbing is that a lot of kids don't really imagine the future anymore. Like they are just waiting for it to happen because, well, we have this imaginary about flying cars and going to Mars and stuff like that. It still exists, and that was actually surprising to me. But yeah, a lot of them told me about like fires and floating and stuff like that. So I actually met some scientists, sociologists that are in Denmark. I met them in the Burning Man, but they are from Denmark and they are working on the vision of the future, imagining by the kids, like how can we help them to imagine, because it's their future also. So we have to also work with younger generation in order to create an environment that they can, I don't know, imagining a future from that.
And did any of these kids talk to you about your bike, or were you able to talk to them about bicycling? I mean, were they interested in knowing how to ride a bike and using a bike just because it might be fun?
Yeah, that was the most funny part, because every time when I arrived in a group of kids, I made a little introduction, like just telling them what I was doing. And a lot of times, like, the reaction was really, they didn't understand why. Why don't you take a plane? Like, it's so easy and it's so quick. And why would you took a boat through ocean with no internet for like forever? So it was actually very interesting, because a lot of them don't know what CO2 is. They don't really know the impact of taking a car, for example. Mm-hmm. So that was the main introduction. But I have to say, I saw very different level of children of school, and also very different social backgrounds. So I guess it depends on where and what kind of school it is and stuff like that. Right. I think, yeah.
Yeah. So again, if you are just joining us, we are nearing the end of the hour with Julia Bourdais, who is joining us from Europe to talk about her travels, mostly by Amtrak and bike, but also by boat, to the United States. So if you have a question or comment, this is your time. This is the time to give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9, and celebrate Earth Day with us. So Julia, you spent time at Burning Man, and I know I don't want this to be kind of the focus of the hour, but I'm so curious, because everything I've read about Burning Man makes me think I don't understand it. I don't get it at all. And why and what? So maybe you could help explain it to me.
Well, I think I don't understand it. No. I was looking for utopias in USA, and like, for example, I went to Women's Land in Oregon, which is like utopias built in the 70s. It's like, I don't know, land habitated by only women. Mm-hmm. And so obviously Burning Man is one of the like most famous utopias in USA. But I think what's interesting now with Burning Man is that it's representing the world. And so a lot of people come to Burning Man with the original utopias of leaving no trace and to survive and maybe to, I don't know, build a beautiful art and stuff. But you have 80,000 people in the middle of a desert. So it's completely, I don't know, the utopia has has gone, like it's over. Like there is so many people. So I think it's very, it's a complex event, because I can tell that a lot of people still have this utopia in mind and like the community spirit. But I have to say, if I was not there to make an interview, I would have, I think, hated it. Mm. But because I was there with my curious mind and wanted to, you know, like discover it, I found it fascinating, because I can tell that from one good idea, because I generally think that the main idea of Burning Man is good, but maybe there is too many people, too many globalization, too many money. I don't know. So now I will go to another Burning Man in Europe, just in order to see like what it became on another place. Like, does it bring the same energy of overconsumption and I don't know, buying a lot of stuff from Amazon? And I don't know. I'm still full of question about this event.
And I'm sure that that will be a part of the book too, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah.
So were you riding your bike to or in or around Burning Man? I mean, was that even possible?
Yes. Well, actually, a lot of people come with a bike, but you are not allowed to bike to the event. So I had to take a shuttle, a bus, with my bike on another vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so I arrived with my bike on the what they call the playa, which is the place of the event. But yeah, no. And yeah, I think it's so interesting. The places where I was not allowed to ride my bicycle were not the one that I imagine, like on the port, on the Marius, of course. When I was trying to go to the park, the national park of the Rocky Mountains, I could not, and going to the Burning Man, and I don't know, it was not the image that I have in mind. Right. So,
and we have a question from a caller who wants to know what kind of bike you were riding.
Oh, so my bike, Satan, is a Decathlon. I think it's a French brand, but maybe it's, I think it exists in USA. It's a touring bike. So it's a kind of bike, like, I don't know, it's a mix of different kind of bike, yes. But it's very strong. It's very, like, you can tour. I have a friend who toured the whole world for 1 year. She made Marseille to India with her bike.
Wow.
And she had the same. So she just told me, like, yeah, go for it, because this one is the good, is the one. And I have to say that I'm completely amazed by this bike, because I had no flat tires.
Oh, that's incredible.
That's crazy. I don't know how it happened. Well, I was doing a check in every big cities, and I replaced sometimes the tires, but no flat tires on the road. So crazy.
And Julia, I'm sorry, we are at the end of the hour. We have to stop here. Thank you so much for joining me. Merci beaucoup for joining me on today's show. It's just been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
So, thanks to so many people: Diane Stojanovic of UW's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, Eleanor Conrad of UW European Studies. Thanks to Sarah Gabler, our producer, John Lang, today's engineer, Shelley Pittman, WORT News Director. And thank you, WORT listener, for tuning into today's show. Happy Earth Day. Ride your bike. Catch Julia's Zoom on Sunday, April 27th at the Arboretum. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Thank you so much.
Information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
so you've got these basically these five or so huge web and Meta, Facebook is in there as well, organizations that are programming weapons of war that are useful to the big primes. They're useful to Lockheed.
Conversation about the militarization of artificial intelligence and how big tech companies, along with traditional defense contractors, are working together to bring in a new era of weaponry. Our guest is investigative journalist Peter Byrne. He is launching a new 10-part series on this very topic. It's called Military AI Watch. He joins us next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, I'm Eileen McHugh with the BBC News. The IMF has warned that among advanced economies, the US will be hardest hit by a significant slowdown in growth, driven by President Trump's tariffs. Michelle Fleury reports from the IMF meeting in Washington.
In a sobering report, the International Monetary Fund warned that the decision to raise tariffs to levels exceeding the highs reached during the Great Recession marked the start of a new era, one that would slow global growth and hit the world's largest economy hardest. The IMF slashed its US growth forecast by nearly 1% in its quarterly report on